amazing how easy it is to drift,
isn't it? You can drift through school, drift through college or some other form of training after school, drift into a job, drift into marriage, drift into buying houses and cars, drift into parenthood even. All the time, borne along like a boat without any clear sense of direction. It's amazing how far a person of reasonable intelligence and family background can get through life just drifting with the tide, not making any major decisions for themselves, just taking the line of least resistance. But there are times, aren't there, in our lives, when, for one reason or another, the drifting stops, or at least is challenged. Questions occur to us. Questions like, why am I here? Where am I going? It's interesting that human beings should ask those sorts of questions. They never seem to occur to the animals. They're content to survive. They don't ask why they're here or where they're going. Survival is enough for them. It doesn't seem to be enough for us, at least not in those critical moments in our lives when the drifting stops and we start asking questions. Sometimes it's because some crisis has come into our life. An accident, bereavement, a broken relationship, a failed exam, something like that. Or sometimes it just seems to arise out of our inner sort of psychology. We get to a phase, perhaps as we're growing up, when such questions seem to arise spontaneously in us and we feel we ought to find answers to them. Sometimes when we're about halfway through our lives, the so-called midlife crisis, we get a similar kind of period when we start asking fundamental questions about our destiny, our reason for existence. It's those sort of questions that I want us to think about in these three evenings together. Because, of course, not to have answers to those questions is to be dissatisfied and empty and disoriented. I'm not saying you can't get through life without answers to those questions. As I say, most people do. They just drift along. But there is something fundamentally unsatisfying and unsettling not to have answers to those questions. Of course, once you start facing up to them and asking them in earnestness, inevitably that three-letter word, God, appears, at least in the middle distance. Why am I here? Where am I going? Those sort of questions invite God talk, don't they? It's hard to know how you would try to answer them without, in some way, getting a bit religious, or at least philosophical. But can we really believe in God these days? There was a time, of course, when the vast majority of people, 99.9% of people in this country, would have considered you somebody worthy of deportation if you dared to say you didn't believe in God. Atheism was akin to blasphemy, akin to rape, akin to all kinds of the most heinous crimes. And certainly not something which ought to be confessed in respectable society. And in fact, in the vast majority of the world, broadly, that still holds true. I mean, atheism, unbelief in God, is a very, very rare position. Even in Iron Curtain countries, where atheism has become the official creed, it's amazing how few people actually are atheists, and how well the Christian church and even other religions like Islam survive in spite of all the indoctrination, in spite of all the attempts of the scientists at Smolensk to breed religion out of their populace. Nevertheless, in our Western society today, belief in God is not quite so easy, is it? Many of us, I think, have problems with God. Is it really credible? Is it really plausible? Is it really likely that God exists? We have a great many people who are willing to stand up on television, or sit down usually, isn't it, on television, and tell us with great earnestness and conviction that they don't believe in God, often given prime-time television. It's regarded as perfectly intellectually respectable these days to be an atheist. So can you really believe in God anymore? Well, obviously that's a pretty fundamental question, and so that's where we're going to begin tonight. And I want to suggest to you three reasons why it is possible to believe in God, and indeed why maybe you should think seriously about believing in him if you don't already. Here's the first reason. I believe in God because he makes sense of the universe. Now, the great philosopher Immanuel Kant said something once that's always struck me. He said, you know, if the stars only came out once every 1,000 years, then men would believe and fear. But he said, we get used to the stars because they come out every night. So we don't wonder at them as we should. There's an element of truth in that, I think. Perhaps we sit too much in front of the television set these days, too, to really sense what a fantastic, what an extraordinary, what a mysterious place this world we live in is. But of course, scientists, whose business it is to explore the cosmos, they're not in any doubt about that wonder and that mystery. In fact, the extraordinary thing is, the more we find out about the universe, the more wonderful it seems. You might think that science would demystify the cosmos, that as we found out more and more about the way the universe works, about the stars, about the planets, about the nature of matter, that somehow it would all be demystified and all this religious talk wouldn't be necessary anymore. But quite the opposite is actually the case, you know. Scientists, as they discover more and more about the universe, become more and more mystical in some ways. There's a book here by Paul Davis, The Accidental Universe, it's called. He's written a lot of interesting books, actually. If you see his books in a bookshop, you might like to pick them up, but they're not always easy. Some are easier than others. He's the professor of theoretical physics at Newcastle, so he's no idiot when it comes to science. One of the things he's constantly pointing out in his books is that, really, it doesn't make sense to put the universe down to chance. You probably know, well, maybe you don't, that our Earth, according to the astronomers, is just about where that purple arrow is, in a big spiral galaxy that we call the Milky Way. It's just one tiny little star amongst thousands and thousands and thousands of stars. Well, 10 to the power 11 stars, actually, in that spiral galaxy. Light takes millions of years to cross from one side to the other. Around that sun, there are planets. I've just drawn three of them there, though there are more than that. And the third one out is our Earth. And that's where we live. It's remarkable, really, isn't it, to think that we're just a little tiny blob on that little tiny country, on that little tiny planet going round that little tiny sun, in the middle of that, well, you might say rather large galaxy, if you didn't realize that there are thousands and thousands of those galaxies scattered through the universe. Makes us all seem rather insignificant, doesn't it? And yet, you know, when you look into it, we're not insignificant at all. It is quite remarkable that human beings like us should exist at all. I mean, take the universe, for instance. I mean, the cosmos, the galaxy, the stars of which we're a part. The forces that hold this great universe, this great cosmos together, scientists now recognize are basically four in nature. There's gravity that we've all heard of since Newton saw his apple fall. There's electricity and magnetism, which are really one force, although perhaps we think of them as two, they're really one. And there are two rather mysterious forces that actually hold atoms together. which most of us don't know a great deal about, but which scientists talk about. They call them the weak and the strong nuclear force. Those four forces are the fundamental four forces of the universe. And their relative strengths and weakness is enormously important. For instance, gravity is a very weak force. The nuclear forces are comparatively enormously strong. The relative strengths are determined by things called constants in equations that scientists love to write. They give them letters like G and C and H. C is the speed of light. H is something called Planck's constant. There are a number of other constants that scientists talk about. And these are the constants that actually define the strength of these forces which hold our universe together. As Paul Davis explains in this book, if those constants weren't exactly, and we're talking about to a decimal place here, the size they are, if they were only slightly different, the universe couldn't exist as we know it. There would be no galaxies. There would be no planets. There would certainly be no human beings. The kind of universe we have depends upon, as he puts it, an extraordinarily fortuitous chance. Let me just read to you a passage from his book, where he talks about this fine-tuning, as he calls it. The nature of the physical world depends delicately on seemingly fortuitous cooperation between different branches of physics. In particular, accidental numerical relations between quantities as unconnected as the fine structure constants for gravity and electromagnetism, or between the strengths of nuclear forces, suggest that many of the familiar systems that populate the universe are the result of exceedingly improbable coincidences. That's why he calls his book The Accidental Universe. Interesting, isn't it? He says something else is interesting, too. According to scientists these days, the universe began with a big bang. You know, once all these galaxies were crammed into a very small space and exploded apart. Nobody really understands the physics, the theoretical physics of the instant of the Big Bang, but scientists think now they can describe the motion and the nature of the universe from pretty close up to when the Big Bang happened. At least they write equations about it. The interesting thing is, you see, that you would have thought, if the Big Bang had happened, as they said it did, that the universe would be, well, not homogeneous, the laws of physics would be sort of different in different places, that these fundamental constants wouldn't be the same everywhere, that there would be a kind of asymmetry in the universe. When we're talking about galaxies millions and millions of light years away that have no connection with one another, why should they all obey the same laws? But the extraordinary thing is that wherever you look in the universe through your radio telescopes that they stick out so proudly over at Barton, you seem to see the same kind of physics. This is what he writes about this. It's hard to resist the impression of something, some influence, capable of transcending space-time and the confinements of relativistic causality. Don't worry about that. It's hard to resist the impression of something possessing an overview of the entire cosmos at the instant of its creation, and manipulating all the causally disconnected parts to go bang with almost exactly the same vigor at the same time, and yet not so exactly coordinated as to preclude the very small-scale, slight irregularities that eventually formed the galaxies and us. Now, I hasten to say that Paul Davis isn't a Christian. But he does give a very large chapter in this book to what's called by physicists these days the anthropic principle. Because some physicists are so amazed by what seem to be these accidents, these fortuitous coincidences, that they feel that somehow the only explanation that the universe is as it is because we human beings are here to observe it. Listen to what one physicist, Brendan Carter, writes about this so-called anthropic principle. The universe must be such as to admit the creation of observers, he says. This anthropic principle represents a radical departure from the conventional concept of scientific explanation. It claims that the universe is tailor-made for habitation, that both the laws of physics and the initial conditions of the universe obligingly arrange themselves in such a way that living organisms are subsequently assured of existence. In this respect, the anthropic principle is akin to the traditional religious explanation of the world, that God made the world for mankind to inhabit. Now, who would have thought you'd find a sentence like that in a book on astrophysics from a professor of theoretical physics today in the 1980s? Eh? Of course, everybody knows that science has disproved religion, don't they? Everybody knows that scientists are against God. Everybody knows that ever since Laplace made that famous statement to Napoleon, "I have no need of the hypothesis of God," he said, that religion and science have been at daggers drawn. But you see, it isn't true, is it? It's a myth. A total misunderstanding. When you talk to the scientists who really know, it's quite clear that belief in God is an immensely rational, intelligent thing to do. Oh, I'm not saying they all do. But if they don't believe in God, it's for other reasons than their science. Their science is increasingly pushing them to the conviction that, well, God is a very good explanation of the universe. The same goes, of course, for the whole question of life. The origin of life is a question that's held interest ever since the Darwinian revolution in the last century. And enormous amounts of work have been done on it. Of course, the usual sort of thought which people have as being generally accepted amongst scientists today is that there was a kind of primordial soup, a kind of chemical marshland in the early Earth with all kinds of primary molecules and compounds floating around in it, and that out of this, by some strange quirk, some chance, life began. That's the way people usually describe the origins of life today. But you know, in 1966, I think it was, there was a big conference in Philadelphia when some mathematicians got together to try and do some sums to work out what the probability of that taking place was. You know, that by chance, out of this chemical soup, molecules of DNA or protein and the things of which human living cells are made, that these chemicals would just be produced accidentally. And I'm afraid when they did their sums, they came out with ever such large numbers. Such large numbers that many of them said quite publicly they didn't believe it was possible to ascribe the emergence of life to pure chance. Fred Hoyle, for instance, who's a very famous mathematician, he reckoned that if you were going to create the enzymes of a living cell in that kind of chance way out of a biochemical soup, the chance would be 1 in 10 to the power 40. That's 40 noughts. One after the other. Now, when you realize that the Earth has only been in existence, according to scientists, perhaps 10 to the power 15 seconds, then you realize that a chance of 1 in 10 to the 40 is a pretty long odds. In fact, talking about chance itself may be a misapprehension. I mean, it's one thing to talk about chance when you're standing on a golf tee, you know, shooting your ball and saying, "What's the chance I'll get a hole in one?" Because you can keep on trying then, can't you? 1,000 times, 2,000 times, eventually you'll get it. Do it often enough and you can work out what the probability is that you'll get a hole in one. But you can only talk about chance in that scientific way because you can have a lot of tries, thousands of tries. But when it comes to the universe or to life, you see, well, we haven't got loads of tries. We don't know how many tries we've got. When scientists talk about chance being the cause of the emergence of life, they're really abusing that word chance. They're using it in a different way from the way that strict science, statistics, talks about chance. What they really mean, interpreted into layman's language, is, I do not know why it happened. That's what the word chance means in that context. When you've got a one-off thing, like the emergence of life, to say it happened by chance is formally exactly the same as saying, I do not have any mechanistic explanation for this. I do not know why it happened. It simply happened. And chance is simply a shorthand word for that confession of ignorance. Fred Hoyle, of course, who did his sums, as some of you probably know, believes that the only explanation for life being on Earth is that genes arrive from outer space. He has a kind of Buddhist mystical belief that life is being spontaneously created out there in the universe all the time, and that these spores of genetic material float in with the cosmic waves and land on Earth. I haven't found any yet, as far as I know, but they're looking hard. Crick, the scientist who, with Watson, discovered the DNA structure, he's even more bizarre. He believes that life must have been brought to this planet by extraterrestrial intelligence. He puts it all down to some ancient astronomer's boot, bringing in some spore of living material from some distant galaxy and planting it here, and there it grew. That is where scientists who've done their sums are reduced to, you see. Because they know chance just isn't a good enough explanation. Now, I'm not saying this all amounts to truth. Please don't get me wrong. There's no way you can prove God from looking at the universe or from looking at life. All I'm saying is that even non-Christian scientists are beginning to recognize that there is a valid question here. Why are we here? God makes sense of the universe. And they're beginning to take that more seriously, once again. God, you see, is not an anti-intellectual, unscientific cop-out. It's a perfectly reasonable response to the mystery of our existence. That's the first reason I believe in God, anyway. Second reason for believing in God. He makes sense of us human beings. Now, of course, there are two models for human beings that have become popular in our day, which are, if you like, anti-Christian or anti-God. There's the animal model, and there's the machine model. Some people like to liken our behavior to animals, and they do experiments on rats and monkeys and draw parallels to us human beings. And some people like to liken us to computers, and they create models of human behavior in their cybernetic machinery out of electronics. Dr. Edmund Leach of our own university here expressed his confidence that one day a complete description of man in biochemical terms would be obtained, and that would show that there is no sharp break of continuity between what is human, he said, and what is mechanical. Basically, we are just a machine. But when you actually look at human beings closely, it seems to me there are certain things which it's very difficult to make sense of on those animal or machine models. I mean, self-consciousness, I've written that up there as one. Just the ability to formulate the question, am I just an animal? And that seems to me to indicate a strange capacity for standing outside yourself that no animal seems to possess. Arthur Koestler, in one of his books, comments how you can insert a platinum wire in somebody's brain and passing a small electric current down, it has to be a small one, passing a small electric current down it, you can make them move a limb. And when you secure that physical response and you ask them, why did you do that? Quite commonly, well, they will say, well, I didn't do it, you made me. And of course, if we want to, we can move that limb voluntarily, using our own self, our own power of will. We can activate those same neurons in the brain from within rather than without. How do we do that? It's a clever trick, isn't it? Doing it when we want to. The human mind is an extraordinary, extraordinary thing. Of course, it's possible to argue that mind is mechanical in origin. The last Reef lecture some of you may have listened to, a man tried to do that. He tried to say that mind was basically just a kind of macro property of all these electrons buzzing away. And I suppose the implication of that would be if you made a computer of sufficient complexity, it would start to manifest self-consciousness itself. But I'm not at all sure I find that terribly convincing. Another thing that seems rather unusual about us human beings, creativity. Now, that doesn't seem to me to be like the animals. I know thrushes make nests, and bees make honeycombs. But human beings, we're architects, aren't we? The world has produced many builders, but man is an architect. There's something different, isn't there? The animal world has produced many singers, but man is a composer. The animal world has produced many mimics. What gave man his originality? Is that really just a difference of degree, or is there a qualitative discontinuity between animals and human beings there? But perhaps supremely, the thing which marks us out as human beings is our sense of moral values, our conscience. W.H. Thorpe, in his book Biology, Psychology and Belief, puts it like this. He says, man alone displays the mental ability to form what he calls the correlation of universals and governing principles. He explains what he means like this. Man recognizes eternal values which are in themselves good. Of course, we find in the higher social animals behavior that appears altruistic. Nevertheless, he says, I believe at this level we do see a difference between what is human and what is animal. Now, he's a man of faith, and obviously you could say he's prejudiced in coming to that conclusion. But I think there's no question that there is a problem explaining why moral values are so important to us human beings. You can rationalize man's moral conscience in terms of behaviorism or genetics even, the so-called sociobiology. There are various ways of explaining why we feel this strange word ought. I ought to do something. We can put it down to herd instinct or social conditioning and things like that. But it does seem to me that we don't really believe that's what it is. If we really believed that when I say I ought to do something, it was just a kind of vestigial remnant of herd instinct in my animal origins, or just a consequence of the way I'd been parented when I was a child, and there was nothing more to that moral value than that, if I really believed that, it would immediately lose its power over me. I wouldn't feel bound by it anymore. But deep down, I do believe it's more than that. Now, once again, I'm not suggesting this in any way constitutes a proof of anything. I'm not saying that one can conclusively show the inadequacy of the animal and machine models for man this way. But it does seem to me that we have a cause to be puzzled by man. When you try to stretch human beings on this sort of Procrustean bed of our modern scientific models, either a machine or the animal, we find certain bits won't fit. And in fact, the only way you can really make man fit is by tearing some part of man away, by reducing him in some way to something less than what we really know a human being is. And yet, you see, there is a better explanation. It seems to me that when the Bible says man is made in the image of God, it offers us an explanation, a rationalization of these unique features of man that makes eminently good sense. I mean, take self-consciousness, for instance, this strange ability that we human beings have to feel ourselves as the subject of our own actions, to get outside ourselves and look down on what we're doing and to pass a verdict on them. even feel guilty when we don't like what we're doing. It's interesting that the Bible says the most fundamental thing about God is that his name is I Am. When Moses asked God who he was, that was the name he was given. I am who I am. Interesting that, isn't it? That God is self-conscious. That God is the agent of his own actions. He's the eternal subject. I am. Could it be then that our strange, mysterious ability to feel like that too, and to say, I feel we have a self-awareness like that, could it be that that's simply a reflection of this God who made us in his image? Or take creativity, another distinctive of us human beings. What is God if he isn't the creator? The Bible portrays him in that book of Genesis, making the world just like an artist. He says, let there be life, and there is light. Then he steps back from what he's made, and he says, yeah, I like it, it's good. Just like an artist with his brush in his hand, stepping away from the canvas, you see. And he does it again and again, building his universe up, just like an artist, with creative imagination, expressing himself as he does so. God says, he speaks. Could it be then that when we human beings display creativity, that we're just expressing that same characteristic, the image of God in us? We have imagination because God has imagination. We're able to be creative because that's the essence of God himself. But it's in the explanation which this gives of our moral sensitivity that perhaps this image of God explanation scores most heavily. Because, of course, one of the things, most fundamental things, the Bible keeps on insisting on about God is that he's righteous, that he has a moral nature, that he cares about right and wrong. But these things are not just accidents of human culture, but they derive from the fundamental one who stands behind our universe. Moral absolutes are real because they're grounded in this absolute person. That's why they come so naturally to us. That's why they're so deeply ground into us. That feeling of ought is a reflection of the fact that when God made us, he made us in his image, a moral being. Now, I know the cynic will say, all right, in all these perplexing areas of human self-understanding, this image of God concept seems to make sense of our human awareness. Okay, but the cynic will say, that's not because God made men in his divine image, that's because man has made God in his human image. You've projected onto God human attributes. That's, I suppose, what was argued most forcibly by Freud in his book, The Future of an Illusion. He said that religion was just a mystification of these strange emotional things that we human beings found difficult to understand about ourselves. And I've no doubt you can rationalize it that way if you want to. But again, I don't find it wholly convincing, do you? Isn't there lurking in the back of your mind somewhere a strange, maybe even an uncomfortable feeling? Maybe God is there. And that brings me to the third reason why I believe in God. He makes sense of Christian experience. Let me read to you some words which come from the Gospel of John. This is what the Gospel says. This is eternal life, that they may know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent. I want you to notice that word know. It's different, of course, from the word prove, isn't it? Sometimes when we use the word know, I suppose in a sort of scientific environment, we do come close to the word proof. I know that 2 + 2 = 4. How do I know? Well, I can prove it. I know that water is made of hydrogen and oxygen. How do I know? Well, I can prove it. When we talk about scientific knowing, often we are thinking in terms of proof in some kind of way. But there's a whole orbit of our human experience, isn't there, which uses the word know in a completely different way. I'm talking about personal relationships. When I say, I know Joe Bloggs, I don't mean I put him in a test tube and shaken him up and found out what he's made of. I mean that there's a relationship between us, a kind of interpersonal connection. He knows me and I know him. We're familiar with one another. When I say, my wife loves me, I don't mean that I've attached a voltmeter to her and measured the cerebral neuronic sort of impulses associated with seeing me in the morning. Do I? It's much more subtle than that, but it's real, isn't it? When we talk about knowing a person, we're not thinking in this scientific orbit of proof. But we are talking about something that's immensely important to us and real to us and that we all know about. And when the Bible talks about knowing God, it's using the word in that orbit of meaning, not in the scientific sense of being able to prove God exists, because as we've seen, you can't do that. Oh, I'm not saying that God's unreasonable or irrational or that you have to be a bit of a loony to believe in God. I hope you've said enough tonight to show you that actually, even in this scientific age we live in, believing in God is a very sensible thing to do. It makes immense sense of the universe. It makes immense sense of us human beings. But you can't prove he's there. And I hope you're not foolish enough to expect me tonight to prove him to you in the way that you might prove a geometrical theorem or prove that the chemical formula of water is H2O or something. Now, this knowledge that the Bible talks about when it says that they may know you, the only true God, is personal knowledge. Experiential, interpersonal, relational knowledge. Just like you're knowing a friend. It's not amenable to analysis any more than my relationship with my wife is amenable to scientific analysis. But that doesn't mean it's unreal, does it? Thousands and thousands of Christians around the world testify to the fact that they do know God, that he's real to them, that when they pray to him, they're not just talking to the blank wall. They know he's there. They relate to him each day. They share their life with him. Are you really going to put that all down to illusion? They're all fooling themselves. Well, you could do, of course. You're at liberty to do that. But do you really believe it? For Christians, this personal knowing of God focuses right down on Jesus. That's why our text says, this is eternal life, that they may know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent. It was Jesus who made this intimate, personal knowledge of God possible for us. Because in Jesus, God has come to us as a person, as another human being. It was easy to fear God, perhaps, before Jesus came. It was possible to believe in him as the source of wonder and power in the universe. But this personal knowing, that was much more difficult. Till Jesus came and said to his disciples, if you've known me, you've known God as well. That's what Christianity is all about. knowing God personally in Jesus. And if you'd like to find out more about that, well, the first thing you can do is come along for the next two talks, and we'll be exploring that a bit further, particularly next Sunday when we're talking about why I believe in Jesus. Or if you can't wait for that, then make sure you take away a copy of Ultimate Questions tonight, because you'll find lots in that book about that very issue. We're going to spend just a few moments in quietness so that we have the opportunity to think over these three things that we've talked about tonight. Why believe in God? He makes sense of the universe. He makes sense of human beings. He makes sense of Christian experience.